Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So one of the things I've been remiss about on this retreat, in many retreats, is I haven't explained the kind of rituals we use here and the bowing. And I just take it for granted. I just do it because I've been doing it for 45 years. And I actually live in a Buddhist bubble. So I just float around from, you know, the world is 99% Buddhist for me. It's only Home Depot and we're working on that. So I forget sometimes. Anyway, someone mentioned it. So first of all, the shrine has on it, it has a tanka painted by Spijak Molski, who lives in Bielowisza, Poland. And there's I hope you've all noticed that there's one of the images around is different than the others. I mean, if you're going to pass this retreat, if you're going to pass the test, I'm going to ask you tomorrow, which is one of those images is significantly different and why. But anyway, so Zbizhak made that. And then you have the Buddha image, which was made in Thailand. And then you have flowers. Susan's going to rearrange soon. Where's Susan? Is she gone? Oh, there she is. Have you rearranged them yet? And then you have the candle. These are in jokes. So, the idea of the shrine is that it is symbolic, symbols rather than idols. So if you bow to the image with the idea that the image somehow has a power that will charm and affect your life in some way, then that would be idolatry, obviously. I think we all know that. But to dismiss the rituals as being idolatry would be equally foolish, kind of cultural chauvinism. So it's rather like the Vicar General, as Thomas Merton goes to the Gaul Vihara and has his enlightenment experience. The Vicar General is dismissing paganism and reading the guidebook on what the anthropologists say. Right? So the Buddha image itself is in a meditative posture, and that's so all Buddha images speak through the posture, through the mudra. So you have teaching mudra, and then you have calling the earth to witness, Abhaya mudra, this one. So you have different kinds of mudras which have iconographic significance. And you have different postures, standing, lying, walking, sitting. And then you have different art forms, different styles, national styles, or sect styles. So you have Mahayana styles, you have Theravada styles. So there's a lot of history and art. So those of you who go to the OBS in onto the Tuan Pagoda, I've often indicated to you that the Vietnamese Buddhists have a reverse swastika on the chest, which is disturbing if you come from the iconography of 1930s Germany. But of course that iconography comes from his country, and it's 3 or 4,000 years old, and it's the chakra of the wheel. So to an Indian sensibility, that symbol on the heart chakra is more than appropriate. To a European sentimentality, it's just sentimentality, it's disturbing. So, again, but anyway, this is in a very refined form, in the Gupta form, 10th century. And it's you can look in again aesthetically as an objet d'art and have an aesthetic critique of it that way. As a religious symbol, a spiritual symbol. And I use the word religion in an anthropological way, not in a theistic way. Unfortunately, that word has become a pejorative word now. You know, like if you say you're religious, you're stupid. But it's actually, any anthropologist which would say that Buddhism is a religion. So Westerners say, I'm a Buddhist, but I'm not religious, because they're so afraid of the word, for good reasons. You know, there's a lot of stuff that goes on in the name of religion which is not religious. But the highest connotation or that thought around that word is religio, binding to, and you bind yourself to the deathless, to the unconditioned, the uncreated, the unoriginated, the unformed. So that's where religio comes from, ligament. It has a deeper meaning, but over time, religions have become equated with power and superstition and child abuse and all manner of things. So please, no religion. So hence, because of that, in our Western culture, we tend to use spirituality. I tend not to use the word religion because I know people's hackles are going to go up. But it is an interesting thing to watch. And this is Sila Bhatta Paramasa, this idea of belief in rites and rituals. We think we're not superstitious, but you get a word like that and the hackles go up and what's the context of the word? You know, where is this word actually coming from? What's its meaning? So, but not to, it's understandable, right? So you could say what goes on in Myanmar is it's been really, really more than sad, very disturbing. But that's not Buddhism. Obviously, that's not what the Buddha taught. So people say, well, anything but religion. But then going back to the image itself, it's the idea of the Buddha image is awake. Okay, that's the root of the word, awake. And so when you look at a Buddha image, that's the principle, is to awaken to the way things are. So even if you don't like religious iconography, you can use it to awaken to the feeling of not liking religious iconography. It's beautiful, isn't it? It's beautiful. So it's not a demand of it's not like an allegiance to the imagery. It's just knowing imagery affects me this way. And if you don't like the imagery, the beauty of it is great. Don't use it. But I use it, so you're here. Here we are. So obviously I like it. I have some beautiful Buddhas in my room. But I can understand. I'm totally sympathize with reactions that people might have. But realize that's our Western culture. We are culturally conditioned, but we're conditioned through very good reasons. Conditioning isn't bad, but we can interpret things through these cultural lenses. So I remember once I was at a meeting in Wellington of Krishnamurti people. And I started with Krishnamurti, so huge fondness for that, the way of Advaita. So I went to this meeting with some others, and people looked at me like I was an insect, because I was wearing a robe. Oh, this must be one of those. And it was very interesting to be true. It was almost like a racist kind of thing, because I wore a robe, and then hence I was superstitious, and I was da-da-da-da-da-da, and it was uncomfortable, because I was, I was all keen, let's talk about Advaita. And this woman looks at me like, you cockroach. Thanks. That's Sila Bhatta Paramasa. It's kind of cultural conditioning, how we will look at something but never really look at it. Our whole cultural conditioning comes up that way. Anyway, back to the Buddha. So then you have also flowers, a candle, and usually you have incense, but because of fire eggs and so on, and we all cough when there's incense, I do. I'm not using incense today, but flowers represent sila. Sila is the ethical, the sense of ethical goodness, moral purity, you might say. Even morality sometimes, or purity, these words people don't like. It's a funny old world, isn't it? Anyway, it's being good. Sila in Nepali. And then the incense would be samadhi. And that's the refinement of the fire on the incense stick, or the fragrance would be the fragrance or focus of a mind which is not scattered, which has samadhi. And then the candle flame is the light which dispels darkness. So sila, samadhi, panya is a classic triad that you have in Buddhism. Morality, concentration, and enlightenment, liberation, wisdom. Sila, samadhi, panya. So that's the package that you have there. And so then when you set it up, you don't necessarily go through all that when you bow, but you have that sense of coming to all those values when you do bow. Now, bowing itself, there are many traditions of bowing. There are many traditions of non-bowing, and then there are minimalist bowing, where you come into the door and then you do that, and then that's it. Till you go out. That's the minimalist approach, which is kind of a secular approach, I suppose. And then there's the maximist approach. Is there such a word? Okay, which is the Tibetans with their full-length prostrations. They're magnificent. And so, like when I was teaching in Peterborough the other month, one of the teachers came up to me and he did his full-length prostration in front of me. It's really lovely. So if you go to Bodh Gaya, you'll see monks and lay people and nuns actually doing full-length prostrations as a practice. Very, very athletic. And they'll do, like, they'll be doing over months, maybe 100,000 as a practice. You'll see in Tibet around Mount Kailash, around the pilgrimage, you'll see people, in Ajahn Sumedho, I haven't seen, you see monks doing three steps, one bow around Kailash, and the highest pass is 18,000 feet. Right? So, you look at it and think, these guys are crazy. Right? But you don't know their minds. You don't know what's in their minds, do you? So different ways of bowing and different ways of coming into the room. So can I just recommend the way I do it? And again, is that the way I've been taught is that when you come into a shrine room, the first thing you do is you bow to the shrine, and then you sit and you meditate. And when you leave the shrine room, you bow to the shrine and meditate. If a teacher comes in and you've already bowed, you don't need to bow. Well, I notice some people do that. I don't know where it's coming from, another tradition. But like for me, I'd prefer actually, if you're meditating and I come in and I bow and I face you, don't disturb your meditation. Or if you need a bit of back exercise, then bow. You know, I'm easy either way. But it wouldn't be necessary. So if you don't know the etiquette, you can get very confused, and you know, wanting to be a good Canadian citizen, you want to do everything right. But then, wanting to do everything right, you might start to resent it because you think, well, what's all this bowing going on? So another way to look at it is, like, if you don't really want to bow, to actually use that as a practice, because I really don't mind, and I'm happy everyone do it, but actually look at self-consciousness then, because that'll come up too. You know, you think, well, I'm not going to bow. I don't really feel like bowing. Are they watching me? Is the Ajahn watching me? So either way, you know, you're stuck between a rock and a hard place. But with awareness, you're free to experience what you experience. Now, obviously, everyone's... Like, if I go into a Catholic church, I don't do the rosary, I don't do the Stations of the Cross, I don't kneel on my knees and pray, and I'm an anthropologist. So if that's another good attitude, to just come as a generous-hearted anthropologist, and that's fine. You can do that in any Buddhist institution. People are fine with that. If you're from another, secularism is very important to you, and religious iconography or devotional practices, you find irksome, then use that. And then see, that's your cultural conditioning. And notice someone else is doing it, actually they're really happy doing it. And look at that, oh yeah. Then don't look at them as a fool, because that would be cultural chauvinism, wouldn't it? We can't understand other cultures, you really can't. You can only, when you're in them. But you don't have to be. We don't have to be dishonest and kind of think that we should like it. But it's like awakening. Why do we have to do all this bowing? Well, what does it feel like rather than carry it around all day? Because like a lot of the rules as a monk, I don't like them. And I certainly my first. Why do we do all this stuff? And this is what it feels like not to like the rules. But I know darn well that I'll never find a perfect institution. It just doesn't exist. So I said, well, that's good enough. I'm not hurting anyone. And that kind of frees you, doesn't it? So please do like just recognize how these things affect you. But if you want to use the pattern that I use in my monasteries, come into the shrine room, bow, sit, and be quiet. And then we have the bowing with the pujas. And then if you go into any Hindu temple or Buddhist temple, just see what they're doing, just watch what they're doing, and then do as much as you want, be polite. Like in Thailand, you would never point your feet at the Buddha image. That would be considered rude. And I've seen, like, that's in Thailand, but not in Sri Lanka. So I've seen in our monastery sometimes, someone from Sri Lanka, because they're elderly and their legs hurt, they stick their feet out to the Buddha, and they're not being disrespectful. A Thai person's conditioning, that's disrespectful, and they get uptight, get really uptight. Oh, don't do that, right? But it's just culture operating, right? Even though the person, like the Thai person might rationally know this person is not being disrespectful, they've been trained since they've been 2 years old, get your feet back. Get your feet back. And you watch mothers training their kids, no, feet back, feet back. Not further, no, feet back. And so by the time they're 6 years old, they stick to, no. And then cultural conditioning, which is very graceful in Thailand. The Thais are very graceful people. And so on. I learned a lot from the Thais, just watching them, how they move between each other and so on. Is that it, I think, around shrines? Have I done it, Andre? Okay. So, and then if you want, like, if you have a Buddha image or something, do try to treat it with respect rather than just... being flippant about it or whatever. It's nice. It's a nicer gesture. So that was that. What did I want to talk about? That was what I wanted to talk about. Okay, so we've been chanting the four Brahmaviharas, the four reflections in the shower from the Messiah. Abundant, exalted, immeasurable. The last one is equanimity. What's abundant equanimity? What's exalted equanimity? What's boundless equanimity? Well, with the first three, you can kind of get a sense of that, I think. And so boundless kindness or loving kindness is the sense that it all belongs. That's what it really means. And on a personal level, it's the refusal to the wishing that all beings be free from suffering, and it's the opposite of wishing beings ill. So it's goodwill, just goodwill. That's all it is. It's not liking people. So talking about love and kindness, it can sound like you like someone, but I can dislike someone but still have goodwill. Right, that's possible. I can't like everyone. I don't know about you. I don't find it possible. And I don't make it a problem. But I can see my mind moving towards ill will and say, no, may they be free from suffering. So I can differentiate that. And so if that's boundless, unlimited, measureless, then it's to all beings in all spaces, in all times, in all directions. That's the idea. So that's the visualization you might do if you're doing that kind of boundless practice. And then compassion in the same way, it's the opposite of cruelty. So all beings who are suffering, may they be free from suffering. We can understand that in a boundless way. Empathetic joy is that, it's just a delight in the success of others. We'll have a hard time with that one, with people we dislike. You know, if Mr. Trump is happy, you probably find it difficult to say, oh yeah, good on you. Very hard. You can, he's happy. True, isn't it? And I mean, that's not saying you like someone that you don't like, but kind of protecting the heart from its pettiness, its jealousy, its mean-spiritedness, I suppose. So take that, but like equanimity, first of all, it's a word that in English often sounds very cold. But these four are always conjoined. That it's a peace, really. It's one teaching because it's about the heart. And if you missed any of the four, I think you'd be missing the potential of the heart. And this also maybe it's a way of talking of liberation. When the heart's liberated from greed, hatred, and delusion, this you might say, is the way it naturally functions when it's free from all the self-making, I-making, the preoccupations, all the things we preoccupy, and it's available in that way. Then it responds to the human situation from those four avenues of goodwill, compassion, joy, and peacefulness. So they're not. You know, it's like you don't respond with joy when someone breaks their leg. You respond with compassion. You don't respond with compassion when someone has a really happy moment. Oh, you poor thing. That's not compassion. What is that? That's feeling sorry for, right? So these are the natural there's a natural connection of the heart that's responding from a place of not being self-absorbed. So you try to apply that to yourself, like, you know, goodwill towards yourself, compassion to your own suffering, you know, recognizing the goodness that you do have and celebrating that. And then equanimity. So equanimity in Theravada Buddhism has to be in that whole package. That's very, very important. Otherwise you take it. If there's only compassion, then you can get burnt out with compassion if you don't have equanimity. Or joy, you can get overly excited. Or equanimity without the goodwill can also be very cold-hearted. So it's a peace, I would say. So equanimity, then, is the peacefulness of mind. And the way we talk about that is just the nature of our experience is that it's dualistic in terms of pleasantness and unpleasantness. So when you, like, say, if you're working in the office and people praise your work, then there's a certain buoyancy to that feeling. And then people disparage your work, then there's a certain depression to that feeling, right? So, but it's a given. You know, being incarnate in a sense body and being, having a sort of emotional programming and whatever, you do feel praise and you do feel blame in certain ways. or success and failure, or health, ill health, bad health, good and bad. So we live in this kind of dualistic world, and we try to navigate that. And then equanimity is the kind of reflection on, well, how can you navigate that or be with that in a peaceful way rather than just being bounced around like a leaf in the wind. So say for myself, like it's as a teacher, I get feedback. People tell me, oh, that was really effective, thank you very much. Or people tell me, I didn't understand what the heck you're talking about. And they affect me. They affect me as a person who's trying to develop the craft of teaching. When someone says it's effective, I say, oh, okay, good, I'll remember that. That works, great. And so I keep trying to hone the stuff that works, right? And then people say, I really didn't get that at all. And then I inquire, so what didn't you get? Oh, I see, okay. That kind of person, that doesn't work. Okay, so that's craft, right? And that's, if I didn't have that kind of feedback, I could, you know, I'd just be in some kind of abstract. But also, of course, when people praise me, I like it. And that's nice. And if people don't like what I say in some way, even though they might not be criticizing me, I can take it very personally. And that can take me to self-doubt. So one is very buoyant, and one is very deflated. You know, balloons? And if I don't understand that that's also natural, and it's just a condition that comes and goes, then what do I start to do? I start to do things to make sure that person that deflated me, that they get a bit of extra time or whatever, right? So I start to, I don't do this, but I start to react or respond to them to get praise out of them. And we've all done that, right? And then when they praise me or they like me, oh, I get that buoyancy again. Oh, that's a good one, yeah, I like that. But then they're looking at me funny. Oh, they're not smiling, uh-oh. So then I have to, and you know the cycle. And then the buoyancy thing, you know, wow, yeah, life is great, I'm a greatest, I'm the best thing since sliced bread, da-da-da-da. No, Viradamo, be careful. And someone punctures that. So, if I've been doing that for 30 years, then, okay, there's going to be some habits there that will come up, and which will keep me very much up and down. But if I decide that I'd like to, you know, what is that fourth Brahma-Vihara called equanimity? What is that? What is that? What is that about? And I realize, oh yeah, I watch this sort of up and downness, and I begin to use that contrast to find out what doesn't go up and down. Of course, it's awareness of change. So then I start to like get much more in contact with praise, and there, that's that, and then blame. It goes into self-doubt. Okay, and I see this two movements, and because I'm seeing movement, I'm with the unmoving knowing of change, I begin to develop equanimity. Not because I've eradicated like I've gotten to some, oh, you shouldn't feel anything when people praise you. And you should just be totally cool when they call you a rubbish pit. Yeah, good luck. Because that's not life, you know. You do, you get moved by these things because we're emotional beings, we're sensitive, we're vulnerable. We're social beings, you know, what people think is, you know, it's very important to us. So to make conscious that when someone looks at you with a sour face and you, they're important in your life, right? And you feel funny or disconnected or whatever, you try to communicate and all the rest of it, but you're getting to the space, oh yeah, with that as condition, the mind goes down. And when this is continued, mind goes up. Well, it doesn't go up and down. And that's the awareness of change. Now, if you do that, then, of course, the fluctuation gets less and less. Because you don't fly off the handle into the floating atmospheres of praise, but also you don't fall into the pits of self-criticism, self-disparagement, and doubt. You know, it starts to balance out. And that is the training in equanimity. And if you see how the causes and conditions for self-doubt are thoughts around self-doubt, but they're also getting off on the praise. You know, they're one package, really one thing. And so you feel doubtful and unsure, and then you want to go to the person and make sure. Like, I used to do that with talks. You know, I'd kind of be just full of self-doubt, and don't ask them. Was it a good talk? I asked. And they said, oh, yes, Bhante. But I didn't really know, because I had asked. And then, you know, I'd give a talk. And I really think it was great. I said, what did you think? They said, I didn't get it. What? And then I give a talk, which I thought just like really rubbish. And I said, oh, God, what a pathetic talk. And someone come and praise me. I can figure it out. But what I could figure out was the mind going up and down. And I could figure out good feedback about, okay, that is practical, that works. So that wasn't about praise, it was about craft. And that, you know, that doesn't really work. It was a nice experiment, doesn't work, and that's about craft. But this other, you know, this other is about wanting and insecurity and, you know, all that stuff we have with people. And that's very deep-rooted, isn't it? It's very profound stuff. But it is the stuff of equanimity. Because where else are you going to develop equanimity? You're not going to develop it when you're in the forest. Yeah, you will develop in the forest, but the triggers aren't there. So that's a good place to be. Go in the forest, hug a tree, thank the tree devas and so on, and then come back into the hurly-burly and see, how does this move? How does it move in mind? Equanimity is very hard, isn't it? I'm sure they're full of devas out there. This place is gorgeous. So for me, that, like Andrew was saying about the contrast, right? You know, when you see contrast in movement, so if you're doing lots of metta bhavana and then you see your mind become cynical or critical and you've done metta bhavana, you say, oh yeah, it's different. Okay, where's it going? Or if you've actually contemplated the movement from praise and blame and just seen it rather than try to change it all the time. I guess I've been trying to reinforce that. You know, before you fix it, before you change it, what is it? You know, get to that place first, right? Rather than just the instant judgment that we do and the, oh, yeah, that's not awareness, it's just programming. So that kind of, okay, this is buoyancy. And again, if that's been a really deeply embedded insecurity in me around that, then it's going to happen a lot. But grist for the mill, and the kind of willingness, because the very place that I lose equanimity is the place where I learn about equanimity. It's just so obvious, isn't it? The very place where I lose my balance is the place where I gain balance. When I was in June, was it? I was on Cortez Island, yeah. Desolation Bay. Desolation Bay, is it? And I did a couple of day longs in Cortez Island, and then we did a 3-day kayaking retreat. I highly recommend it. And Cortez Island and Vancouver and BC. But anyway, I was we were on the boats and we're meditating and what was I on about here? Why did I go to Cortez Island? I forget. I was about praise and blame. Oh, it's such a good story too. About, oh, it's such a good story. I lost it, damn it. I was such a good example. It'll come to me tonight.
Oh, the grist through the mill.
Yeah. Oh, yes, balance, okay. So, thank you.
Oops.
Oops. you know, what's really nice about this? I'm not embarrassed. That's lovely. Right? You know, you get embarrassed by these things. That's nice, nice, well done. Anyway, where we were camped, there were no sand beaches, and it was very rocky. And where I live, it's very, very flat. And very rocky, very hard to move around, big boulders and so on. My balance is very poor, which I was disappointed in. But just 3 days camping out, my balance had improved. That was interesting. So we're going to dig up all the trails at Cincinnati. But you know, that's what I mean. You gain balance is where you're feeling in balance, right? So in equanimity, you get it in those places where you get thrown off balance. You need enough mindfulness, of course. Like if you get thrown off balance, that you hit your head in the rocks, and it's time to get a bit of concrete and flatten the place out of it. But that's always the principle of developing these really wholesome qualities. But those four are very important in understanding, I think, what we mean by liberation. Because if you just talk about it in terms of egolessness or emptiness, then it sounds very, very dry, to say the least. And too probably philosophical, right? Too ethereal, too sort of woo-woo out there. But if you talk it about more in the ways of the heart, then yeah, I can relate to that. I can see how when I'm really kind of self-critical, it's not a happy state. Certainly isn't the Brahma-viharas. It feels a bit more like hell, actually. And how could I get back to the open heart? Well, I could say, oh, even self-criticism, it belongs. You see, and then I'm back with the heart, with goodwill. So you have goodwill towards ill will. Right? And when the ill will is pointed to yourself, you think, well, I should just like myself. It's not liking yourself, it's just seeing that ill will towards yourself, there is no one to, you know, it's just a construct, that's all. And you change the construct by introducing, oh, and even that belongs. Huh? So you're not trying to get rid of that. Huh? And then that compassion and joy and so on. And these are the manifestations. And you meet someone like Lompo Cha or great teachers, you can just feel it, can't you? Ajahn Chah, he was such a radiant being. In this biography, which some of you might read, he can sound really fierce and tough and so on. And the difficulty with that, with any biography, is the fierceness is sort of gave the stories. But the quality of the being could use the fierceness in ways which were very effective and everyone kind of appreciated. But then in a biography it can sound too fierce. For me it's great. But anyway, that just as an addendum to that. So tonight is the last night. And then you'll be returning to Ottawa, Dundas, Waterloo, Guelph, and you'll be returning to responsibilities or to your own soft bed, and you'll be able to read the newspaper at breakfast and all the rest of it. But awareness will neither be here, there, nor in between. It's here. So when you're driving and you make your first pit stop to Tim Hortons and have a big box of tin bits or something, and then you feel guilty afterwards, then this is a feeling of guilt. Ah. So endings, right? They feel this way. So, you know, you're kind of half excited, half frightened, whatever your mind's doing with endings. It was different than the beginning, right? But awareness doesn't, you know, awareness knows beginnings and endings. But yeah, I don't see it. You can't beat it, can you? And then, you know, you'll feel apprehension or relief or whatever, wherever you're going. And then you'll get there, and then that'll change. So take refuge in awareness of change, and then that'll serve you well.